This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. The day-to-day grind of the justice system doesn't have the dazzling appeal of Hollywood, but legal arguments and courtroom scenes have provided some of the most dramatic moments in cinema. So we asked you to weigh in on your favorite legal moments on the silver screen, and we're going to hear from at least one listener later in the program. But joining us now to talk about those is North Carolina film professor Marcia Gordon. Welcome back, Marcia. Good to have you.
Thanks, Frank.
Also with us, North Carolina Museum of Art film curator Laura Boyes. Laura, welcome back. Good to have you here.
My pleasure. Thanks.
So we're going to make this kind of a regular thing, get together once a month, talk about films. And this month, we're going to talk about films that in one way or another involve courtroom scenes or the legal system. And they really are a staple of American popular culture, Laura, right? I mean, we're riveted.
We seem to be obsessed with crime in popular culture these days. And I think it's because we have such a need for justice being done. The world seems like an extremely chaotic place and everything is out of control. But somehow when you get people into a courtroom, the truth will be known. Whether this happens or not in real life, I'm a little less clear, but it pretty much always happens in the movies.
Well, and it's not just justice, but injustice as well. And I think we are drawn to that idea that in a courtroom, we can at least, you know, on screen create the illusion of fair judgment and somebody, whether it's a jury or a judge, making a decision that is, you know, morally right in the end.
All right. And I think probably a pretty good example of this kind of film, straight ahead, crime and justice film, Witness for the Prosecution.
You are registered, are you not, under the National Health Insurance Act?
Aye, that's so. 4 and 6 pence are paid every week. Oh, that's a terrible lot of money for a working woman to pay.
I am sure that many agree with you. Now then, Miss Mackenzie, did you recently apply to the National Health Insurance for a hearing aid?
For what?
My lord, I must protest against the manner in which this question is being put.
I will repeat the question, my lord. I asked you in a normal tone of voice audible to everyone in open court, did you apply to the National Health Insurance for a hearing aid?
Yes, I did.
Did you get it?
No, not yet.
However, you state that you walked past a door which is 4 inches of solid oak. You heard voices, and you are willing to swear that you could distinguish the voice of the prisoner, Leonard Vole.
Who?
No further questions.
Oh, maybe you could help me, Your Lordship. 6 months ago, I applied for my hearing aid, and I'm still waiting for it.
My dear Miss Mackenzie, considering the rubbish that is being talked nowadays, you are missing very little. You may stand down now.
As apt today as it was in 1957 when that film was made.
Yeah, and this is, you know, this is a film I've been watching for a long time. This is one of my father's favorite films of all time. So, and I think one of the things that comes across in that scene and in this film is that one of the things that's appealing about this kind of film is the wit and the rhetoric. I mean, this is a perfect combination of Charles Laughton, you know, playing this role of doing this cross-examination, and it's simultaneously trying to craft an argument by example. So it's an example of, you know, clever rhetoric, and then also it's funny, and it gets the courtroom laughing, and it gets the audience laughing, because it would be pretty relentless, and there are courtroom dramas that are serious from start to finish, but almost all of them have moments of great comic relief.
And of course, Charles Laughton is he's a ham. I mean, his character is very flamboyant, and he's a skilled enough actor that you as a viewer hang on every word, just as the way everyone in the courtroom would be hanging on every word of his character.
And in this particular film, this is one of those types of courtroom films where there is a truth. And because humans are involved in this, we can actually find it. Somebody's lying, and if you're clever enough, you can get to it. And so that's comforting. That gets back to what you were saying, Laura. We really want these kind of answers, right?
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, I mean, that detective element of these courtroom dramas, I mean, it's not that there's actually a detective in the film, but that one of the attorneys is playing that role. And in fact, it was so important to this film, which is based on an Agatha Christie story, that at the end, there is this explanation that, please, I know you were excited by the surprise ending of this film. Don't tell anyone what happens in the end, because that's part of the gift of the courtroom drama, is what is the verdict.
And it also shifts the conflict away from criminal versus victim to lawyer versus criminal, which is a much different kind of intellectual battle.
And lawyer versus lawyer, more important.
Right, that's right.
But it gives us confidence that this process is going to get us to the truth, that
yes.
clever enough. Then we get to a film like 12 Angry Men, which examines the process. This whole question that we had taken for granted, or answer that we took for granted, is really under examination in 12 Angry Men.
It's always difficult to keep personal prejudice out of a thing like this. Wherever you run into it, prejudice always obscures the truth. I don't really know what the truth is. I don't suppose anybody will ever really know. Nine of us now seem to feel that the defendant is innocent. But we're just gambling on probabilities. We may be wrong. We may be trying to let a guilty man go free. I don't know. Nobody really can. But we have a reasonable doubt. And that's something that's very valuable in our system. No jury can declare a man guilty unless it's sure.
Well, I think unlike Witness for the Prosecution, which is actually not just about the truth and a just verdict, it's about the manipulation of the legal system. I mean, 12 Angry Men is a very different iteration of the genre. I mean, it starts with the judge telling the jury that they have to make this decision, and the entire film basically takes place in this deliberation room where these 12 men have to come to this decision. And I think one of the important things about this film is that it's really about ethics, and it's about this one juror played by Henry Fonda, who takes a stand against 11 other men who just want to convict this man of killing his father. And, you know, over the course of the 2 hours of the film, you know, takes each argument, under consideration in a way that challenges the beliefs that the film begins with.
And it's also, in this case, about casting as well, because Henry Fonda as an actor has a particular star persona. And if this character was played by Peter Lorre, you know, you would not necessarily believe what he was saying. But the fact that it is Henry Fonda, you as an audience are inclined to believe whatever it is that he's telling you.
Yeah, and in courtroom dramas in general, even though this one, you know, takes place in a deliberation room, I mean, these are actors' roles. I mean, this is not action. This is people sitting in a room for typically an entire film.
It better be interesting.
Right. And I think that's why you get, you know, Gregory Peck and Henry Fonda and Spencer Tracy. I mean, these kind of solid male performers, who really get to have fun with language and speech. And that's part of the pleasure of watching them.
But it does play out. And you've mentioned this before, Marcia, the idea that it's a courtroom drama is a drama in three acts, so that it lends itself well to this kind of dramatic portrayal.
Yeah, absolutely. The three act structure, you have the crime. You have the whole procedure of investigation and the trial, and then you have the resolution, satisfactory or not. So it is this very tidy structure that that these dramas can play out in.
And all of them, it seemed to me, point to something else, which is this aspiration that we develop a process by which the truth can come out. It will be rational. It will be devoid of emotion, so that we can get to the absolute truth apart from our prejudices. And of course, what makes a courtroom scene great is the outburst. It's the emotional outburst in the face of this logical process, right?
Absolutely. And I mean, I think every courtroom drama has a moment of at least one, if not two, moments of outbursts, some of them verging on true hysteria.
Which I think in an actual courtroom is much less likely to happen, because the attorney's law, at least as I've learned from the movies, is, you know, never ask a question that you don't know the answer to. And when the attorney makes the mistake and asks that question, that's what often creates the emotional scene in a courtroom drama.
Yeah. And you know what? I have a real bone to pick with these films in general, because they've created an expectation that I call the Perry Mason moment, right? That if you grill them long enough and just keep asking the question, they're going to stand
crack
up and tell the truth. And everybody expects that, like on a radio show. You know, you get a politician on. And you're just going to keep asking the question this day. Yes, I hate people. Yes, poor people are anathema to me, and that's why I ran for public office. And I'm supposed to get that confession.
However, those politicians have all had the media training, which is only answer the question that you want to answer and don't even pay attention to the other questions, which you can't really do in a courtroom.
But I also think it's one of the things that we wait for in a courtroom drama. I mean, I think you kind of go into them knowing that there is going to be a crack at some point. Somebody's lying. It's going to come out, or you're going to have some key witness appear that's going to just change the whole game. And so I think that given how flat the idea, I mean, if you think about what it means to sit for an entire film in a space and watch characters talk to each other, I mean, on the surface, that sounds terrible, but some of them are so engrossing. And part of it is that they tend to have these moments that rupture, you know, what could otherwise be kind of the tedium of legal procedure.
Well, too, and we'll talk about that and some of the filmmaking craft that goes into making that kind of thing work and the themes that we're exploring as we look at courtroom dramas with Laura Boyes and Marcia Gordon on The State of Things. We'll also hear from one of our listeners who called in and talked about her favorite film. You'll hear it all on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Today, talking about legal drama in film with Marcia Gordon, professor of film at NC State, Laura Boyes, film curator at North Carolina Museum of Art. And we also talked with our listeners, and we asked them to send in their favorite scenes from legal movies, and here's one that received a lot of votes.
My name is Allison Winter, and I'm from Raleigh, North Carolina. And my favorite courtroom scene is from To Kill a Mockingbird. The part that's always stuck out to me the most about this courtroom scene is that it just really is a testament to how the outside world can distort the justice that should be administered fairly to everybody.
The witnesses for the state, with the exception of the sheriff of Macon County, have presented themselves to you gentlemen, to this court, in the cynical confidence that their testimony would not be doubted. Confident that you gentlemen would go along with them on the assumption, the evil assumption, that all Negroes lie. All Negroes are basically immoral beings. All Negro men are not to be trusted around our women. An assumption that one associates with minds of their caliber. And which is in itself, gentlemen, a lie. Which I do not need to point out to you. And so, a quiet, humble, respectable Negro who has had the unmitigated temerity to feel sorry for a white woman has had to put his word against two white peoples.
Watching Atticus Finch exit the courtroom after he's lost the case for his wrongfully charged client, Tom Robinson, has always just made me want to cry and scream and shake the person sitting next to me out of rage, because it's just awful witnessing this tragedy take place. But it's also incredibly humbling because it makes you take a step back and consider the lengths that people will go to do the right thing, especially when it's unlikely that you'll win.
All right, so our thanks to Allison Winter for picking To Kill a Mockingbird, as many people did, Laura. And, of course, it's classic, and it's the one maybe that most people think of first.
Yes, most people think of it first. The American Film Institute did a poll that said Atticus Finch was the most admired character in the movies for his principled stand. And that scene at the end where everyone, you know, stand up, your father's passing, is a scene that many people remark on as being the most memorable, that justice sometimes has to wait. And the time that the film came out was during the civil rights era in the 1960s. And although it represented an era of the Jim Crow South in the 1930s, in fact, it was such a beloved movie that attitudes in real life started to change towards segregation. So this is where a fictional courtroom case in a movie actually had real life repercussions.
And I really like the way that Allison talked about how affecting this scene is for her. And I think a lot of people feel that way about this film. And one of the things that courtroom dramas allow filmmakers to do, and obviously this is based on the much beloved Harper Lee novel, is to talk about other things, you know, race and gender, prejudice, whatever the issue is. It's not just about legal procedure. It's about the culture at large. And I think that that feeling that even when justice is not served, that doesn't make the point any more or less, because the audience often feels that they are on the side of the moral right, correct, rather than, you know, whatever the verdict is.
And this kind of really plays to Hollywood's strengths, which is the kind of exceptional man, the exceptional person, which can also shed light on a system that is inherently and fundamentally unjust. So you can have a conversation around a movie that pretty much fits the Hollywood formula.
Absolutely. And I think that goes to the idea of, you know, the star system and, you know, a performer like Gregory Peck, who has this kind of gravitas and moral centeredness that that just reads so easily on the screen. And I mean, you know, I think that's why the casting of these films is so crucial. And they're almost always, of course, male, you know, characters who take us on these journeys.
Something else about the filmmaking in this particular movie that I found moving, and that is some of the way the close-ups were used when Scout comes to help her father guard the jailhouse, right, and all the townspeople show up. They get shot from behind, and the people are a mob, and you can only see them from the back. And then Scout begins calling them out one by one, and their faces are gently highlighted, and you're not a mob anymore. And this is a pretty powerful, potent theme, that mobs do things that individuals can't. And I think did it better, frankly, than the book ever could have.
Mm-hmm. And I think the fact that the child performers in this film, they're non-professionals, but they are just so right for these parts. And the fact that Mary Badham, who played Scout, really did have a close relationship with Gregory Peck. While the filming was going on, she would climb into his lap, you know, when they were not filming. And the rapport that they built up off camera was something that I think, you know, Peck and the director could use on screen as well.
Well, and the whole idea of mob justice, I mean, there's a Fritz Lang film called Fury that is all about this subject with Spencer Tracy, who also plays a lot of lawyers and judges. I think that part of the idea of the courtroom drama, of that structure of creating reasoned justice, that you can go through this process of argumentation, and then you have something like the mob scene in To Kill a Mockingbird, which is a reminder of what happens without that structured order.
Well, and if the courtroom drama is the fairy tale we keep telling over and over in the hope that maybe it'll come out differently, in the hope that particularly more modern dramas, that reason will out, I think we get to some of the comedies that spoof the whole concept. They get at this notion better, or perhaps the futility of using reason to get to the truth. So if you think of a movie like Duck Soup and the Marx Brothers, whose anarchy undoes any of the social order that you thought just might work, let's get the courtroom scene from Duck Soup, where Chico's on trial for, I think, treason against the great Fredonia.
Ciccolini, when were you born?
I don't remember. I was just a little baby.
Isn't it true you tried to sell Fredonia's secret war code and plans?
Sure, I sold a code and two pair of plans.
It's some joke, eh, boss?
No, but you're 20 to 1 we find you guilty.
Ciccolini, have you anyone here to defend you?
It's no use. I even offered to pay as high as $18, but I no could get somebody to defend me.
My friends, this man's case moves me deeply. Look at Ciccolini. He sits there alone. An abject figure.
I object.
I say, look at Ciccolini. He sits there alone. A pitiable object. Let's see you get out of that one. Surrounded by a sea of unfriendly faces.
Ciccolini, give me a number from 1 to 10.
11.
Right. Now I ask you one. What is it? Has a trunk, but no key. Weighs 2,000 pounds and lives in a circus.
That's irrelevant.
Irrelevant? Hey, that's the answer. There's a whole lot of relevance in the circus.
That sort of testimony we can eliminate.
That's a fine. I'll take some.
You'll take what?
Eliminate. A nice gold glass eliminate. Hey, boss, I'm going to good.
Yeah. Gentlemen, Ciccolini here may talk like an idiot and look like an idiot, but don't let that fool you. He really is an idiot. I implore you. Send him back to his father and brothers, who are waiting for him with open arms in the penitentiary. I suggest that we give him 10 years in Leavenworth or 11 years in Twelveworth.
I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll take 5 and 10 in Woolworth.
There you go. There you go. If you don't know how the system works, it doesn't work against you, I guess.
Well, the funny thing to me about that scene, and it's brilliantly written and brilliantly performed, is that it's really doing just the same thing that the courtroom dramas are doing in terms of language and wit and, you know, kind of twisting ideas, but it's just doing it in this absurdist way. But it's really a mirror reflection of legal procedure and the most cynical view of, you know, all of this kind of game playing that happens with language in a courtroom. So it is kind of a distorted, funny version of that.
Well, because the legal language, I mean, we all know the terminology because we see it on television
right.
every week. But it is a very specific jargony subset of words that, of course, the joke is that, you know, Chico is not a native speaker of English, so he only somewhat understands what's going on. But in fact, most people in a courtroom would be overwhelmed by the vocabulary that's being used by the legal profession and find themselves in a similarly helpless position.
Right. But there's Chico in his world with his vocabulary that requires as much wit, right, and facility with language as a courtroom. And in his universe, none of this is going to make much difference to my future. And, mm-hmm. and so you get the feeling, oh, only if I believe in that system does it harm me. If I don't, then there's lots of relevance in the circus and I can go home.
Yeah. And of course, if you think about courtroom dramas, I mean, rarely do you see stumbling over lines. Everything is perfectly delivered. I mean, it's very much unlike real life. And I mean, that's part of, I think, what's so enjoyable about it is that the courtroom is theater. And that's the way these films play it, whether it's for comedy or for, you know, something more serious.
All right. Well, let's now move into more modern films. Chick flicks with some legal issues, such as Legally Blonde.
But thankfully, that same day, she entered the Beta Delta Pi wet t-shirt contest where she was completely hosed down from head to toe.
Objection. Why is this relevant?
Oh, I have a point, I promise.
Then make it.
Chutney, why is it that Tracy Marcinko's curls were ruined when she got hosed down?
Because they got wet?
Exactly. Because isn't it the first cardinal rule of perm maintenance that you're forbidden to wet your hair for at least 24 hours after getting a perm at the risk of deactivating the ammonium thioglycolate?
Yes.
And wouldn't somebody who's had, say, 30 perms before in their life be well aware of this rule? And if, in fact, you weren't washing your hair, as I suspect you weren't because your curls are still intact, wouldn't you have heard the gunshot? And if, in fact, you had heard the gunshot, Brooke Wyndham wouldn't have had time to hide the gun before you got downstairs, which would mean that you would have had to have found Mrs. Wyndham with a gun in her hand to make your story plausible. Isn't that right?
She's my age. Did she tell you that? How would you feel if your father married someone who was your age?
You, however, had time to hide the gun, didn't you, Chutney? After you shot your father.
I didn't mean to shoot him. I thought it was you walking through the door.
There we go, the reveal. The Perry Mason moment.
We gave it away.
Yeah.
But this also really accentuates the fact that most courtroom dramas are overwhelmingly male. And part of the comedy of this is seeing a very feminine young woman in the courtroom using her very specific knowledge about fashion and beauty to solve a crime is supposed to be funny, which has a little undertone that maybe everyone would not really appreciate.
Yeah, I mean, the film is played satirically, but it is also, I mean, it does point out that issue of the kind of gender inequity of on-screen representations of the legal process. There are very few films. I mean, I guess Adam's Rib would be the precedent with Hepburn and Tracy, you know, the couple who are both lawyers. But yeah, that kind of gender-specific knowledge. And, of course, it's playing with the blonde thing, too, right? You know, blondes being, you know, stupid and not able to navigate. Or when this is about someone who ends up going to law school in order to pursue a boy, of course. But then it turns out, you know, everything gets turned on its head. So in some ways, there is a kind of subversive element to this film if you can look past some of the other
It's a fine line. I mean, you could go either way with this. You could be offended, but you could also see it as subversive. And again, it works. It presumes that you have types in mind.
Yes.
So it's working against what you come your expectations, which other earlier films don't. They create the whole story beginning to end, right?
And I think walking that tightrope is what's made it so popular as a film and as a musical, and it's given it long life in the popular culture. Is that perhaps there are different interpretations? Right.
Well, let's take a look at another one again. We're sort of looking at a more comic vein now as these films progress through time. My Cousin Vinny was a big popular choice among our listeners.
Watch this.
Because Chevy didn't make a 327 in 55. The 327 didn't come out till 62. And it wasn't offered in the Bel Air with a four-barrel carb till 64. However, in 1964, the correct ignition timing would be 4 degrees before top dead center.
What is positive traction?
It's a limited slip differential which distributes power equally to both the right and left tires. The 64 Skylark had a regular differential, which anyone who's been stuck in the mud in Alabama knows. You step on the gas, one tire spins, the other tire does nothing.
Go, My Cousin Vinny.
And this is another courtroom drama where the lawyer is not an expected type, that the fact that he is not a typical law school, well-spoken, smooth, intellectually superior, socially elevated kind of character, once again, acts as a satire of the whole law profession.
But it is also a reaffirmation of the fact that we expect our lawyers on screen to be, you know, the wasp, authoritative, well-spoken.
Right, right.
I mean, those are the roles that are, you know, that's the accepted casting and the accepted scripting as well.
I'm not sure that this accounts for the success of that film, but when you talk about well-spoken, see, that's one of the subversive themes to me in all of this. He's a genius. He has an ingenious use of language. We got to remember this whole argument about Ebonics and what kind of – whether we should be using the King's English. Well, no, there's an ingenious use of language in hip-hop culture that may not sound like it belongs in a courtroom. But that's just because you have a prejudice about what courtrooms should sound like, right?
Absolutely.
So it does underscore the ingenuity of language in all of its forms. So a guy like from New Jersey can be quite clever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, although, again, it's played in a comedic context. Right. So it's not as if this is a serious courtroom drama where that language is playing out. So I would point that out as the difference.
And also the switcheroo is that Marisa Tomei plays a character who does not look like she would have the specialized knowledge that she does. And, of course, she won an Oscar basically for the one scene that's played in this clip because it was so subversive and funny, very funny.
It gets back to the Legally Blonde stuff. I mean,
exactly.
We just don't expect her to know all that stuff. And
exactly.
But I just think it's 90 minutes of New Jersey accents and America can't get enough. What do you think?
Agreed.
It's like that's what sounded. You know, we're running out of time here. What should we do? Do you want to talk about They Drive By Night?
They Drive By Night is another film in which a courtroom revelation got an Oscar nomination for Ida Lupino, who plays this part. And this is actually a film we're going to be showing at the North Carolina Museum of Art a week from Friday. And it's it's not a courtroom drama. It's just a criminal case within a larger film. But it is one of the dramatic highlights of it.
Let's play a clip from that film.
Mrs. Carlson, I asked you where you first met Fabini.
You will answer the question, please.
He was laughing. Yes, he was laughing. Kissed me when he was drunk. Yes, he kissed me when he was drunk. So I got a new car. Yes, I got a new car. And I bought some new clothes. Yes, they were pretty. He used to tell terrible jokes, and he'd laugh at them. He was always laughing. And then I saw him lying there, drunk. I heard the motor running, and I saw the doors. I heard the motor. I saw the doors. The doors made me do it. Yes, the doors made me do it. The doors made me do it.
Ah, Jim Morrison was good. But,
it's not a subtly played scene. But I mean, I think that, you know, there are so many films that have courtroom scenes. It's one of the things that Laura and I have been talking about is that, you know, there's all of these courtroom dramas where the whole narrative revolves around a trial. And then there are many, many films where there is just a scene, whether it comes at the end, which is typical, right? Because that's a way to wrap up a story is, you know, in a kind of nice bow at the end is to have a courtroom scene. And then it also allows for this kind of theatricality that you get from Ida Lupino in this scene that that often audiences really responded to, and well, critics as well.
I'm a big fan of overacting. A naturalistic performance may turn some people on, but I want to see all the stops pulled out.
I agree with you. There's a lot of naturalistic performances in my birthday films. And honestly, I don't even like them anymore, so I'm with you. We're really almost out of time, but how typical – this film was released in 1941. How typical was this film, you know, at the time? Was it that the kind of movie they were doing those days, or was it different?
Absolutely. This fits very neatly into the whole Warner Brothers social problem cycle, because it's about the trials and tribulations of a couple of truck-driving brothers in California. So, yes, it was very much a Warner Brothers film of its day.
But I think just to also draw a line maybe as to something more contemporary, that kind of over-the-top hysterical performance, I think it kind of crops up in interesting ways in a film like one of the films I was thinking about for today was Dancer in the Dark, the Lars von Trier film from 2000. And Bjork plays someone who has this very depressing, terrible life. And she keeps escaping in the film to these scenes of musicals. And there's a courtroom scene in that film where she's on trial for murder. And all of a sudden, it's a fantasy in her mind. But the whole thing turns into a musical number. And it's another version of that same kind of overperformance.
We're going to have you back next month. Next month will be February. I bet it'll have something to do with romance. But thank you very much for being with us. Laura Boyes, film curator at North Carolina Museum of Art, Marcia Gordon, film professor at NC State. Thanks for being on the program.
Thank you.
Coming up next, we'll talk about the paintings of Archibald Motley on display at the Nasher. Stay with us.